From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And tonight is the third and final presidential debate, to which many of you might be saying, thank goodness. This has been called an historically contentious race. So what awaits us? Hillary Clinton has been doing debate prep. Donald Trump has been holding rallies every day. Last night in Colorado Springs, he took a swipe at her.
Sort of funny. She's been doing this for 30 years. Now she has to do debate prep for 5 days. You know what the debate prep is? It's resting. It's lying down, going to sleep.
Well, joining us now are Here and Now political commentators Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist not working for the Clinton campaign. She's in Las Vegas. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And Paris Denard is with us, Republican strategist not working for the Trump campaign. He's in Washington. Hi, Paris.
Good afternoon.
And I want to ask you about what we just heard from Donald Trump there. Are you worried that even though after each one of the debates, Republicans even have said he should have done more prep, that it sounds like that's not what he's – that's not the lesson he's taken away?
Well, you know, Jeremy, when Governor Pence, who did a fantastic job, in my opinion, up against Governor Kaine, when he did his debate, he said that the reason why he did all of those Sunday morning talk shows was to use those opportunities as debate prep. And I believe that what Mr. Trump is doing is testing out lines and tapping into the people on doing all of these rallies as another form of his debate prep, because we all know that Mr. Trump is very good at responding to people and responding in the moment. So I think his deliberate decision to continue to hold a lot of rallies, test out language and see the response of the people is a smart move on him, on his behalf, because he's a different type of candidate and he's doing things in non-traditional fashions that typical regular politicians normally do.
Well,
so I think it's a smart strategy for him.
And Angela Rye, your thoughts both about what seems to be the Trump strategy, but also they're, again, talking about Hillary Clinton's fatigue or needing to lie down and go to sleep. I mean, if we hear that tonight, your thoughts?
Well, I think that the American people are tired of this type of childish rhetoric, particularly on the debate stage when we need to talk about, you know, matters, frankly, of life and death. Robin, we have a situation where terrorism is real in this country. People are living paycheck to paycheck in more instances than we need them to. And instead, we're talking about the stamina and the ability and the intelligence of a woman candidate. And you would think that a bully would learn.
You think that's what this is about, by the way, Angela? Do you think this is about her being a woman? That's why he's saying she's fatigued?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, they've tied in her health. You've talked about her stamina. You can tell when Donald Trump is standing shoulder to shoulder with Hillary Clinton on that stage, it rattles him to his core. He's never had to face a woman as his equal. He certainly, very frankly, doesn't treat any of his spouses or his mistresses as his equals. So I think that rattles him to his core.
Well, I think that leads us to, go ahead, jump in and then we'll talk about that. I would just say
this back to Angela's point. She's absolutely correct when she says this is about life and issues of life and death. That's why Mr. Trump is bringing in Pat Smith, an angel mom, who will be in the audience tonight.
Mrs. Smith. Yeah, her son was killed at Benghazi.
Right. And when you talk about these serious issues like Secretary Clinton's judgment as it relates to her time as Secretary of State and her handling of Benghazi, this is one of the issues that is going to come up, back to Angela's point again, about terrorism. And that's why poll after poll, Mr. Trump continues to lead on the issue of being strong in the minds of the American people on how to handle terrorism.
Well, but it took us about a minute and a half, Angela, for you to make a reference to Trump, the women in Trump's life. And how do you think that's going to come up? And Paris, you take it, the tape of Trump bragging about, forcibly kissing women and grabbing them by the crotch, and then some of the accusations have come out. How does that come up? How do you see that?
I think that Chris Wallace will address it in the portion of the debate that deals with whether or not either of them are fit to be president. One and the same, I think, Benghazi and Hillary Clinton's handling of the Benghazi issue is fair game. I hope that Secretary Clinton tonight will address the fact that, you know what, this is a case in point of Republicans needing to work with the administration. Embassy security was underfunded, and it's time for us to get back to the meat of the matter related to Benghazi. We've dealt with all the fluff and the hoop, but we can't just deal with the drama. We have to actually deal with what happens so we can prevent another Benghazi. I hope she gets to talk about her record as Secretary of State, her record as senator, because she is, as the president has said over and over again, the most qualified candidate to ever run for president. So I hope that there isn't a whole lot of distraction, actually, about all of the women in Trump's life, because that's an issue that we can't solve. He's got to get some help from that, and it's not from the American people. He's got to get help from that somewhere else.
And to that point about the women, I hope that Mr. Trump counters by talking about his record as a businessman, because there are more women than men holding executive positions in the Trump Organization, heading major departments like human resources, golf and hotel management, et cetera. And that's just 43% of the overall workforce. And so he has a record that he can promote and talk about that counters what I think a lot of people in the media and what the Clinton campaign wants to talk about as relates to other parts of his history.
Mm. Well, yeah, not on the campaign, though.
Paris, the thing that Donald Trump has been talking about almost nonstop over the last week is his view that the election is rigged, that the media is rigging the election for Hillary Clinton. Do you think he is going to? Do you think he should bring that up in the debate tonight?
I think that's going to be one of the major themes that Mr. Trump talks about. I think her judgment is one, her readiness to serve, as well as her experience of being in the politics for 30 years and haven't done anything to help advance the things that she's now trying to trumpet. And then now, yes, the issue of this being a rigged election. I think he's going to go back to what we saw that happened with WikiLeaks and all the stuff that's in there, but in particular, going back to the issues that happened about Bernie Sanders. We know that that's a particular voting block, and people are really concerned about the mistreatment at highest levels that WikiLeaks has uncovered, but especially at the DNC and with the campaign. So he's going to talk about those issues because I think a lot of Americans are concerned about what they see and this potential of rigging that is on the record proof in the WikiLeaks.
And what does she
Can
say?
Can I respond
Angela?
To
yeah,
that?
Go ahead. Yeah.
So a few things here. Kellyanne Conway actually was on TV this morning and actually disagrees with Donald Trump about the election being rigged.
Trump
so that's on the record
Trump spokesperson,
as well.
Person, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And well, not just his spokesperson,
campaign manager.
Right, right. The third campaign manager, I'd add. But it's also
third
important
time's
to
charge,
note,
yeah.
You better hope so. I think it's also important to question this. Was it rigged then when he became the GOP nominee? Was it rigged when Barack Obama became the president in 2008 and was reelected in 2012? When did this rigging actually begin? Because as Barack Obama has said to him, you're complaining about rigging and the game isn't even over yet. So you're putting out some very serious accusations about American democracy when you are literally running a tag team with the Russians, hacking into emails and touting that as if it's legal. There was someone arrested for that this morning. So I just wonder where the rigging is really happening, right? If they are breaking into emails to try to sway the results of this election, that seems like more of a rigged result to me than anything else. So if it's rigged for Bernie, from just a strict timeline standpoint, Paris, we'd have to also argue that it's rigged for Trump because he became your nominee.
But there's some other portions of the quote-unquote rigged system as it relates to the fact that there was 23 times more coverage about these unfounded accusations against Mr. Trump than of Secretary Clinton's email situation. So
when you say accusations, what accusations?
The accusations that were made about him and his past issues with women as it relates to the allegations that were made against
him.
No,
those are actually not unfounded. And it's unfortunate that, again, when you deal with the Trump campaign and Trump spokespeople, that women, their word is second guessed against his. Not unfounded.
No, I'm talking about things outside of the video and what he said. I will say on record.
Angela, let me just back up for 1 second because we just have a couple minutes left. And I want to ask you this question, which is, as you look at the polls right now and Hillary Clinton leading in a lot of states and also in now states that nobody expected would really be in play, including Arizona, do you think that the Clinton campaign ought to be trying, if they think they're going to win, to run up the Electoral College count for her, or that they should start diverting resources to Senate races and things like that, in case she becomes president, may help her get stuff done?
Jeremy, that's an excellent question, and it's an excellent strategy question. Perhaps you should talk to the campaign about what they're doing.
Well, you're the
here.
Strategist.
I feel like you just beat me right now. It's a really good point. There are two things. One is you can look at it Like if she runs the Electoral College count up, then it gives her a demand, kind of. It's clear that she has been asked to govern at that point. But on the other hand, if they don't spend those resources on these Senate races and now maybe even these House races, will that mandate really result in a real action? And I would argue that it's probably no. And so spending money and investing in those Senate races that are close, that are neck and neck, some like Nevada, like they actually really do need to spend some resources there. And not just resources. If she's going to be taking time off for debate prep, she should also probably get on the ground and help folks campaign. So I think that's an excellent point.
We just got just a couple seconds. Paris Denard, what does Donald Trump have to do tonight?
Mr. Trump has got a message to the states, people, the voters in Arizona, Utah, Florida, Nevada, which now has been moved to battleground states or lean dim. He's got to talk to middle America, middle class people, and let him know what he stands for, what his record is, defend his record, and actually go after the facts about Secretary Clinton and the lack of her record and the holes in her record in terms of judgment and what she's going to do. He can win this election, but it's going to be tough.
Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, neither are working for the campaigns, but working feverishly today for their parties. Angela, Paris, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A new drug, 10,000 times stronger than morphine, 100 times stronger than the deadly opioid fentanyl, is tearing through the Midwest, particularly Ohio, and headed for U.S. coasts. Carfentanil is legally used as an elephant tranquilizer, but now it's being sold to unsuspecting heroin addicts. Back in August, Cincinnati experienced 174 overdoses in just 6 days, believed to be related to carfentanil. There are test results pending. It's so dangerous it could be fatal to first responders. And there are fears it could be used for nefarious purposes. Commander Dennis Lowe is head of the Major Crimes Unit based out of Lancaster, Ohio, and president of the Ohio Narcotic Officer Association. And Commander Dennis, one of the problems we understand is there's the drug Narcan, which is used to reverse heroin overdoses, but it isn't effective against carfentanil, or you need huge amounts of it to work.
Yes, ma'am, that's correct. And that's certainly a challenge for law enforcement. Typically, what we see with fentanyl exposures is that it takes multiple doses of naloxone or Narcan. And with carfentanil, there is plenty of information available that those drugs aren't effective with carfentanil. So for first responders and officers involved in drug enforcement, it presents a big challenge for us in terms of not only how we purchase through controlled drug buys or through seizures, through normal police work, the exposure risk that it presents to law enforcement, whether through field testing of those drugs or mishandling at those scenes. And we've had officers around the country that have suffered inadvertent exposures.
Tell us more about that, because you talk about there's undercover work, but there's also field testing when you get to a situation. And we understand that carfentanil can be fatal if it's just absorbed into a cut.
That's exactly right. And it presents a challenge for us with respect to it being you're able to absorb it through your skin or through inhalation. And I think that's the real hazard that it presents to law enforcement. And I think it's important for people to understand exactly how dangerous this drug is. We're talking about a drug with respect to fentanyl that a kilogram of fentanyl contains 50,000 lethal doses. A kilogram of carfentanil, the drug that we're speaking about, in a kilogram quantity, there are 50 million lethal doses of carfentanil in 1 kilogram. So the issue for us is that many of the users will take this drug, whether they've obtained it in powder form or it's obtained in a tablet form, and they grind it up. And when they grind it up, it becomes it has the ability to become airborne. And that's where we see a lot of potential for inadvertent exposures. And we've seen law enforcement officers throughout the country, in fact, in New Jersey and in Connecticut, East Coast cities that were exposed during law enforcement activity. It's actually been banned as a chemical weapon. That's how dangerous this drug is.
And it's just crazy, as some of your colleagues out there in the Midwest are saying. Who would, what kind of a marketing strategy is this to kill your customers?
Well, unfortunately, what we see happening is people here in our area don't know that they're buying fentanyl or carfentanil. They believe that what they're purchasing and using is heroin or a stronger variety of heroin. And in fact, many of the people who traffic in this drug do so to support their own habits. And those people that are selling it don't even realize that what they have is fentanyl or carfentanil. Now, certainly the folks who are responsible for importing this drug into the United States and trafficking it throughout the country, they look at it as an opportunity to create a larger market share, if you will, because they can make their product go a lot further by cutting heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine and other drugs that we see with fentanyl and carfentanil. So they're able to increase their profits.
Well, we're hearing people in different areas, Hamilton County out there, saying this is hitting us like a Mack truck. This is carfentanil in particular.
Yes, ma'am.
And the trade route is said to be something like, you know, Chinese manufacturers who make these synthetics, and then it goes to Mexican processors. It gets smuggled into the U.S. Those who are calling for stopping the drugs crossing the border are not wrong there. But it's also being mailed into the country, speaking particularly of the carfentanil, something that we don't even know. It has never been tested on humans. We don't even know what the lethal dose is.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in terms of how this drug gets here, not only are the cartel folks bringing it into the United States, but you're exactly right. You can go on the internet or the dark web and order these drugs.
And it's being mailed around the United States.
It is. It is. And we have postal workers that are handling these packages and unsuspecting people picking these things up. If you want to realize how dangerous this is, just take a little bit of flour and put it in a coffee grinder and grind it up and take the cap off, and you get a sense of how easily something that fine can be become airborne and dangerous. So it's really scary for us in law enforcement, not only the impact that we see with the users and those people battling addiction across the United States, but for the first responders and for people who live in these homes where these drugs are being used. I think that we're going to see a time here in the coming future where we'll see less and less heroin, maybe even heroin no longer is used, and it's all synthetics, fentanyl and carfentanil.
Well, as it gets more powerful, and I'm speaking of the carfentanil again, this an elephant tranquilizer.
Yes.
I'm thinking there's going to be more collateral damage. We know the children are
exactly
around.
Right. Exactly right. And that's a real scare that we have because, as you mentioned earlier, our EMS folks who are out there who respond to these unintentional overdoses are equipped with Narcan or Naloxone. And in many cases, those products aren't going to be effective in reviving those people. And I think we're going to see these deaths skyrocket across the country as this drug becomes more widely used and available.
Yeah. Well, as we said, it's right now in Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, but it is probably coming to a town near you no matter where you are, carfentanil.
I fear that it is.
Yeah. Dennis Lowe, commander of the Major Crimes Unit in Ohio. Dennis, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, yesterday we began a look at inequity and kids and how the many wealth gaps affect young people in particular. Now, normally to measure how well the country's economy is doing, we look at the rise and fall of whole families from one generation to the next. But what happens when there are class disparities within families, among siblings? Emiliano Villa from Here and Now contributor Youth Radio tells us how this played out in his own family.
My sister, Azucena Rosilla, is 16 years older than I am. But the difference between us goes way beyond years. Back when she was my age,
we were able to get a house. Each of us had our room. Our parents would always buy us, like, stuff for Christmas and our birthdays.
By the time I was old enough to remember things like birthday presents, the recession hit. My family's home renovation business took a nosedive, and it hasn't recovered. So, money-wise, my adolescence is completely different from my sister's.
They kind of had no choice but to sort of, like, scale down on the house. They had to move back to a smaller place. They had to go back to you guys sharing rooms. They had to cut back on expenses.
Back when my sister had an after-school job, she kept all the money for herself. I have to use my paycheck to help with groceries and rent.
Hola, hijo.
That's my mom, Gabriela Solorzano. She's much more comfortable speaking in Spanish.
Todo el negocio se fue para abajo.
My mom's saying after our family's business went under, we went from making $2,000 a week to $300 a week, if that. So unlike my sister, when I start college next year, I'll be on my own covering tuition.
This causes a lot of tension within families.
Dalton Conley is a sociology professor at Princeton University. He studies economic inequality within families, specifically between siblings.
The expectation, or at least the fairy tale we tell ourselves, is that inequality stops at the front doorstep, you know, when you wipe your feet on the welcome mat. But really, inequality starts at home.
Conley says when siblings end up with different economic situations at home, it can have a big impact later on.
That's going to be reflected in net worth differences. One of you has to contribute to your family of origin and the other did not. The other sibling gets a jump start on accumulating savings or, you know, for a down payment for a house.
That's pretty much what happened to Evie Layden. Her older sister was accepted into her dream school, Oberlin.
My father, who was a single parent, didn't feel like we were in a financial position for her to go. And so she went to a much less expensive school for a year, which she didn't really like, and ended up dropping out. And then even though it was only 2 years later when I graduated, I think my father just felt a little more equipped to be able to send me to Brown University.
And that one difference between them has had lingering effects.
I definitely had that opportunity that she didn't have. And I know that she has more stresses in her life related to finances than I do.
Despite those stresses, in the big picture, Layden's experience lines up with the American dream, the idea that a family's finances improve over time. But according to a 2016 study from the Urban Institute, millennials are actually less likely than older generations to think they're better off than their parents.
Tenemos cuadros.
My mom's describing the treasures in our antique hutch. Fine china, tea sets, wine glasses, and vases. I've grown up looking at this fancy tableware, which we can't afford anymore. But I don't resent my older sister or my parents. I'm too busy working hard to make sure someday we'll be able to afford that stuff again. For Here and Now, I'm Emiliano Villa.
One of the most closely watched governor's races in the country is in North Carolina, where Republican Governor Pat McCrory and Democratic Attorney General Roy Cooper faced off last night in the final debate of their gubernatorial race. The latest polls show the candidates are in a tight race, with Cooper leading by an average of 1.3 percentage points. Jeff Tiberi of Here and Now contributor WUNC was at the debate, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
And Governor McCrory has been in the national news many times when he signed that controversial voter ID law, just the other day when he was responding to Hurricane Matthew, and then, of course, famously when he pushed that House bill in North Carolina that requires transgender people to use bathrooms that correspond with the sex on their birth certificate. That issue came up last night. Let's listen.
And I've been looking for a compromise for months on this issue, but he will. I'll make a deal with him right now. If you agree to take out this gender identity and gender expression regarding access to our schools, locker rooms, restrooms, and showers, I will support in a bipartisan effort to make sure we do not discriminate against the LGBT community in hiring or firing.
Now, he's speaking there to Roy Cooper, the attorney general. But how big of a deal is the so-called bathroom bill in this campaign?
It's pretty big. People are still talking about it a lot 7 months after it was passed hastily during a one-day special session. It has led to, you know, the cancellation of concerts and conferences and sporting events and things like that. And not only is there the bathroom component of this that is very well known, there's also a measure that bans local municipalities from passing any kind of ordinance that would protect LGBT folks. So it continues to be contentious, and we'll see how much of an impact it ends up having on the outcome of this race and others.
And Roy Cooper, the Democrat, is not as well known outside North Carolina. Let's listen to him talking last night about the economy.
Since the recession, there's been a national economic recovery, but North Carolina is lagging behind. You go ask everyday working people whether they have seen a Carolina comeback, and most of them will tell you they are working longer and harder and for less money than they were before the recession.
What should we know about Roy Cooper and what he's running his campaign on?
He is running to some extent as an outsider, as not Pat McCrory, as somebody who says he's going to continue to help the middle class and grow education. That line in there, the Carolina comeback, that's Governor McCrory's campaign slogan, and he has taken a dig on the governor. And he Cooper has continued to just talk about the damage that House Bill 2 has done from a perception standpoint to the state. And to some extent, he has also run as an incumbent, if that makes sense, and it might not. But Cooper, the challenger who's been the attorney general for the past 16 years, has outraised the governor significantly over the last year and a half, which is uncommon. And he has not agreed to a number of debates. Normally, the challenger wants 5, 6, 7 debates. But this time, it's been McCrory who's been calling for more forms.
Now, North Carolina is a swing state in the presidential race. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in a tight race there. There's also a close Senate race. Is it likely that whichever party wins one will win all three, or are we likely to see split tickets?
Split tickets are historically what has taken place in North Carolina when you think about president versus gubernatorial. There's a long history of those tickets splitting. Of note, of interest, the presidential and Senate ticket has not split since 1968, meaning, you know, it goes RR or DD in each year that there's been a presidential race and a Senate race. Now, Hillary Clinton has a lead here in North Carolina, and that would perhaps bode well for Deborah Ross, who's running for Democratic spot in the U.S.
Senate.
But we'll,
we'll
see. Yeah.
We'll be watching. Jeff Tiberi at WUNC. Thank you. This week, for the first time, Donald Trump's campaign is set to spend more on television advertising than Hillary Clinton's. But when you factor in ad spending by outside groups, she'll still come out ahead. So far, the Clinton campaign has outspent the Trump campaign on ads by about $114 million. So where is the money going? Steve Passwader is vice president and general manager at Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
And if you look at the overall ad spending this year, it looks like it's actually down. We're not going to set a new record in 2016 over 2012.
That's absolutely right. We won't. That obviously runs fairly contrary to where I think most people's opinion on this subject was a year ago at this time.
And how do you explain that?
Well, it really comes down to it's probably fairly easy to blame this on the Trump campaign, given the fact that Trump, unlike any Republican nominee in recent history, essentially went quiet from the time he won the nomination until late August, when he began to purchase some limited amounts of television time in some battleground states. Now, that spending is coming, but it is far too late and far too insufficient to make up for what hasn't been spent. And on the other hand, when you look at the Clinton campaign and, you know, Team Clinton, if you will, if you'll include the PACs that are supporting her, to this point in the general election, she has not spent as much as President Obama did 4 years ago.
Well, as you look at the ads that are running right now, tell us a little bit about what's going on at the moment. Where are the Trump and Clinton campaigns spending their money, and what about the PACs?
It is the usual list of states that you would, for the most part, that you would automatically assume would be part of this, with some exceptions. I know there have been some headlines in recent days about the Clinton camp buying airtime in Arizona. They have done so before, but it wasn't a lot. Trump, on the other hand, has been recently buying a lot in Wisconsin. Generally speaking, I don't think anybody would have considered Wisconsin to be a battleground state, but the Trump campaign in recent days has been putting some money there. Rather unusual. I don't know the last time Wisconsin would have received presidential general election dollars. It's certainly been a while.
Well, and perhaps even more surprising is the Clinton campaign running an ad in Texas. Listen to this.
The Dallas Morning News has recommended Hillary Clinton for president. This newspaper has not recommended a Democrat for the nation's highest office since before World War II. Trump plays on fear and exhibits a dangerous lack of judgment.
How surprising was that to you that the Clinton campaign is going on the air in Texas? And I imagine that Texas is not a cheap place to advertise in because there are a lot of big cities that are probably pretty expensive.
Well, that's true. And when you look at Dallas and Houston, those are top 15 markets, and obviously they carry a cost structure for media that is reflective of that status. And clearly, one of the deals that Trump appears to be having issues closing is that there are a fair amount of Republicans out there who are not convinced to vote for Mr. Trump. And in doing so, I think Mrs. Clinton is obviously reaching out in a way to try to tell those voters, hey, look, it's okay. This newspaper that you've trusted for how many years now is actually refused to endorse the Republican candidate. And of course, that's been going on all over the country.
Meanwhile, here's an ad from the Trump campaign.
Our next president faces daunting challenges in a dangerous world. Iran promoting terrorism, North Korea threatening, ISIS on the rise, Libya and North Africa in chaos. Hillary Clinton failed every single time as Secretary of State. Now
this ad shows footage of Clinton nearly collapsing after the 9/11 ceremonies when she had pneumonia. As you look, Steve Passwaiter, at the totality of the ads that are running, are they more negative like that, or are there positive ads running out there as well?
Well, at least where the Trump campaign is concerned, it seems as though the tone has gotten much more negative in recent weeks. The Clinton campaign seems to be doing some contrast ads, comparing her judgment or her stability versus the Trump campaign. And in a lot of cases, as far as the Clinton campaign is concerned, they are using Trump's own words against him in a number of ads. There's the Mirrors ad, which struck me looking at young ladies who are at that very vulnerable age and then having Mr. Trump's words in the background that wouldn't seem to be doing much to bolster the self-esteem of young ladies. That, I thought, was a particularly powerful ad that has been running. So these are rather interesting ads where all you need to do is let your opponent's words ring out, and it sort of does everything for you.
The TV landscape is very different than it was just 4 years ago. A lot more people cutting the cord, getting their media elsewhere, getting their media online, social media. Has the political spending moved in that direction, or is TV ad spending still as important as it once was?
There is no question that when it comes to who rules the roost in political advertising, local television still carries the day by far. However, there is clearly some movement towards digital media. Particularly, I think we've reached the point in time where Facebook and YouTube, something on the Google side, and companies like Snapchat and Twitter are now being seen as must-haves for campaigns. So when all is said and done, television will still have the overwhelming share of political dollars. But there's no question that the digital world is starting to make some inroads and is making itself much more appealing to candidates and the groups who support these candidates. I will also say that the major digital companies also have a fairly large presence here in Washington, which I believe when you're trying to establish relationships and position yourself as a great platform for political advertisers is absolutely the right thing to do. And I think they're doing it well.
That's Steve Passwaiter, Vice President and General Manager at Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me here.
Well, something amazing happened on Monday on the game show The Price is Right. Three contestants went to spin the big wheel in the Showcase Showdown, hoping to land on a dollar. The first contestant stepped up.
65 for a dollar! 65 for a dollar!
Then a second contestant came to the wheel.
50 for a dollar!
Another dollar. And then a third contestant spun the wheel.
This just might happen. 70, tie, three-way tie, three-way tie, three-way tie, three-way tie!
Host Drew Carey said of that three-way tie, I don't know if that's ever happened. Well, to find out what the chances are for a three-way tie like this, we're joined by Elisa Long, an assistant professor who teaches statistics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. She's with us on Skype. And Elisa, you had a student in your class approach you about this very question. What did you figure out?
Yeah, that is correct. I should give a shout out to my student, Nick. And if you think about the chances of this happening for the first player, there's about a 5% chance that they land on a dollar on one spin. And then, of course, they have a chance to do it on one or two spins. So if they don't do it on the first spin, like suppose they get a 25 cents on the first spin, On the second spin, there's exactly one way of getting to a dollar. In this case, spinning a 75. So the first player actually has almost a 10% chance of hitting a dollar in one or two spins. Now, part of that depends on whether or not they choose to spin a second time. So if they spin a 90 the first time, they're probably going to stay. But assuming that they always spin twice, they have almost a 10% chance. And then the chance, of course, that all three players do this is just 10% times 10% times 10%. So it comes out to be a little bit less than 1 in 1,000.
And you say that, by the way, as an expert in statistics, but also as somebody who was on The Price is Right, went through it, spun the big wheel, got to the next round, and then won two cars.
That is correct. So about 2 years ago, I was on the show, and I ended up tying it with the first contestant and then entering a spinoff and winning that portion. And then I made it to the showcase and ended up winning, which was a lot of fun.
That's Elisa Long, an assistant professor who teaches statistics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management and former Price is Right champion. Elisa, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thousands of under age 30 leaders in entertainment and industry are here in Boston for the Forbes Under 30 Summit, panels, pitch contests, success stories, including The Skim, a daily email with short summaries of the news. Now, it has 4 million subscribers and recently got $8 million in funding from 21st Century Fox and another $500,000 from The New York Times. Danielle Weisberg and Carly Zakin founded it in their apartment just 4 years ago. Danielle, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
And Carly Zakin, hi to you as well.
Hi, nice to see you.
Now, let's remind people, in 2012, you quit NBC News.
We did.
Yes. Okay, let's just, you know, there was a time, and we've talked, I worked at NBC News, there was a time when that was the pinnacle.
There are no two people who wanted to work at 30 Rock for NBC News more than we did. We grew up trying to intern there. We worked there in college, worked our way up until we were producers, and we absolutely loved it and feel like we learned from the best in the business, but also felt like the economy was not on our side. Graduated in 2008, and that combined with media changing, we kind of found ourselves in a position to not have a clear path forward.
Yeah, that's Danielle. Carly, when you say not have a clear path forward, I mean, the path is you work your way up the producing hierarchy, you maybe get an overseas posting, but you decided to do an email.
Well, I think actually the path that you're talking about didn't even exist by the time that we were there. We grew up knowing that you always wanted to aspire to have your boss's job, like in the best way if possible. And we saw our bosses were getting laid off and our bosses didn't even want their jobs anymore.
But also you had this idea. It's kind of like a morning news post by email written, as we said, in very understandable ways. You break down stories. So let's say there's the news this week of the FBI and the State Department maybe striking a quid pro quo deal over the status of a Hillary Clinton email. Very complicated, netty stuff. But the first thing you do is do kind of a little 10 seconds remind me, and you remind your readers, okay, what is it we're talking about here? And then you go on and under what's the latest, you outline, really break it into understandable terms. And I think you ended by saying something like, so the story's over, the emails are no longer a problem. Kidding. Because they are, you know, for Hillary Clinton. What is your sense, and I'll go back to you, Danielle, of the simplicity? Why that?
We started the company with two really founding principles. The company came out of what we saw firsthand. Our friends are smart, and they were asking us really basic questions about what was going on in the world. They knew everything when it came to their industry or their interests, but things that came outside of that, they didn't have a news source that they loved. We started looking at who our friends represented, the female millennial, influencing hundreds of millions of dollars in spending, and it was crazy from an economic argument that there wasn't a news source that was geared towards how they actually like to get information. So we focused on two things. One, creating a voice that sounds like your friend. They could trust us to give them the answers. And the second thing that we really focused on, we fit into the routines of this audience. We were really obsessed with how does this audience actually wake up? What are they interacting with during their day? Because that's how we thought we could get an edge in the market.
Right. Well, and Carly, it gives you the freedom that you did not have at NBC News to play a little. So in the story about Aleppo and Russia saying that they will perhaps have a slight pause so that the injured can leave the city, you write, oh, so generous. You know, a little bit of snark that you can't.
Yeah, I think for us, we say it like it is. And sometimes, you know, we've been told you're snarky or you're funny or you have a certain point of view. And I think the only point of view that we have is that we tell information like it is. And the skim is meant to be read in under 5 minutes. And it's meant to give you the tool that you can go to any work event or social event and talk to anyone about anything.
You know, there has been some criticism. Here's Elizabeth Hack in All Hours magazine. And she says it is skim. It's like skim milk. It's like skimming. It's not depth. And, you know, well-informed people don't rattle off trivia. Do you worry that it doesn't have the depth?
We got asked that question all the time when we started. And our answer to that was look at these reader emails where we have thousands and now millions of people writing in and some saying, I never connected with a news source. And all of a sudden, I'm like having out-of-body experiences every day and talking about Syria, talking about North Korea. We're just so thankful that people who might not have engaged with news at all are engaging at such a high volume that they are now.
Also, you see that in the fact that we're Rock the Vote's biggest partner to date, one of them. So we've registered 100,000 people to get out there and vote. People are feeling informed and then feeling like they want to take action on that.
How do you go from sitting on your couch with an idea? What's the one thing that you would tell people? Who do you call? How do you get there?
So I think it's a great question because we had no idea who to call. So we called everyone. We reached out to truly every single person we knew that had started something. And it didn't have to just be in media. We talked to accountants, lawyers, interior decorators, realtors. And we literally kept a spreadsheet of every single person we met. And when they said to follow up and whether or not we should go back to them to ask for money.
We had no money behind it. We had no funding. We had no tech
background.
So
it was just your email with your idea of here's the deal, here's the story, here's the skin.
And we had no shame and we asked everyone to sign up.
What do people at the old-fashioned NBC News say to you?
We've spoken at conferences where some of the leadership has spoken after us. And what we've said is you should have paid more attention to your associate producers. And they acknowledge that. And I think it was very telling when we left that not one mentor of ours said you're making a mistake.
That's Danielle Weisberg along with Carly Zakin. They've co-founded The Skim. I want to thank you both and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much for having us.
And we'll link you to more at hearnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.